Hello, this is World Business Report from the BBC World Service, where we bring you the latest in money, marketing, manufacturing, and yes, much, much more. Please review us, rate us, share us wherever you can. BBC podcasts are supported by advertising.
I'm Gabriel Gatehouse, and from BBC Radio 4, this is Series 2 of The Coming Storm. There's a divide in American politics between those who think democracy is in peril and those who think it's already been subverted, hollowed out from the inside. As America prepares to elect its next president, we go through the looking glass into a world where nothing is as it seems and the institutions of the state are a facade. Listen wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Hello and welcome to World Business Report from the BBC World Service. I'm Rob Young. On this edition, Israel and Lebanon's Hezbollah stand on the brink of war. We'll ask what impact that could have on Lebanon's already shattered economy. Also this half hour, why tensions have resurfaced between China and Japan, Asia's biggest economies, and the boss of the world's largest sportswear maker, Nike, is to step down as the company's market share falls and rivals produce more innovative footwear. Well, remember, you can email us anytime about any of these stories, world.business@bbc.co.uk. But we start with the escalating crisis in the Middle East, where fears are growing of an all-out war between Israel and Hezbollah, a militant and political group in Lebanon, which is also backed by Israel's archenemy, Iran. The past few days have seen some of the most intense cross-border attacks since the war in Gaza started almost a year ago. Israeli warplanes have struck targets in southern Lebanon and in the capital, Beirut. Hezbollah has fired rockets into northern Israel. Lebanon in particular is on edge after an unprecedented wave of explosions of pagers and walkie-talkies used by Hezbollah members. Amin Salam is Lebanon's economy minister and spoke to James Copnell on Newsday here on the BBC World Service earlier today.
The more we escalate, the more the economy goes back. Already, you know, the Lebanese economy has been suffering for quite a while, one issue after another. Now, this adds another layer that really stops growth, stops any flow of cash related to investment, stops any visits to Lebanon from tourists, and puts us in a very tough place now in the economy and on the security front.
Are you seeing that already? Are you seeing, for example, you talk about tourism, are holidays being cancelled or are there investment contracts being torn up as we speak?
Absolutely. The past 3 months, I would say, that witnessed major escalations in Lebanon has really decreased the number of people visiting Lebanon, even the Lebanese diaspora, which is known to be the largest that really contributes to the economy as far as tourism goes and economy both. So flights were canceled, visits were canceled. People that were in country fearing that the airport might close or things might escalate, cut their vacations and left the country. So, yes, absolutely. It has deeply impacted the economy, leaving Lebanon's, summer vacation season and now getting into the winter in a very uncertain place, very difficult place.
I wonder what you can say to investors, for example, foreign investors, that might in any way reassure them that their money would be safe should they choose to come to your country?
Well, to be quite frank, I mean, at the moment, it's very difficult to give comfort and assurance on that front, especially when we're talking investment, which requires stability and security, which both we don't really have at this moment. If you are asking me today, I would tell you we are in very uncertain times. We are looking at escalations by the hour on the war front, and it's not giving anybody any comfort at the meantime.
Lebanon's economy minister Amin Salam there. So with such uncertainty, how are businesses in Lebanon coping? Hani Basali is the chief executive of Basali Foods in Beirut and is a member of the board of the Beirut Traders Association. He spoke to my colleague Roger Hearing.
For the average Lebanese, it's business as usual. We're still doing our business. We're going to our home. We're going to our businesses. Everything is open. In the evening, I wouldn't say that we are in the best shape, but it is really life as usual, in spite of everything. This is the Lebanese spirit.
Well, it is, but I know that you've had a deep economic crisis for a long time. I've spoken to friends who say it's almost impossible to draw money out of banks, to buy things in the normal way. How do you get around that?
I wouldn't say that we have rebounded, but the economy have readjusted. Definitely, it's a cash economy, but we can say now, of course, you know, we have to separate before October 7th of last year and after that, because since then, you know, the things haven't been quite in a good shape. But I would say that in 2023 and even 2024, the economy have in a way adjusted. Salaries have a little bit adjusted. The currency has stabilized. And all over, business has come back to workable levels.
As a businessman, how do you plan what you're going to do?
We just plan one day at a time. But we as traders, as importers, as industrials, we cannot just work one day at a time. You know, if I have to order goods, let's say now we are in September, we have started already to plan for March 12, 2025, whereby you have both Ramadan and Easter. So we are really looking forward. We just blindly close our eyes and work as if there is no hostilities, there is no war coming out to us. Because if you just plan if you are just fearing for the war, fearing that something might happen, then you might as well close your business and stay home.
Business owner Hani Basali there. Well, years before the current tensions, Lebanon, as we were hearing there, had already endured one of the world's worst financial meltdowns in history. Well, this decade, the economy almost halved in size, the currency collapsed and prices spiralled out of control. On the line now is Lael Mansour, a lecturer in economics at the Lebanese American University and is currently based in Kuwait. Welcome to the programme. Just give us a brief update on the state of the economy at the moment and what it's been like in recent years.
Yes, at the moment, the currency has been stable for the last 13 months because we had a new interim central bank governor, acting central bank governor, who refused totally to finance the central bank to pay on maintenance or to pay wages, salaries to servants. So that's why it is somehow stable. And we have also to mention that Lebanon is now more than 90% dollarized, which means that Lebanese people are using only foreign currencies, which is dollar, for wages, for salaries, to spend on the supermarket, for their daily expenses, for fees, for scholarship and tuitions, and everything is now in dollars. So that's why there is no really demand on the Lebanese pound for exchange or since the government is not spending any penny to improve the economic situation. So that's why the government was able not to print, or the central bank was able not to print money. However,
so it's a cash economy, and that cash tends to be US dollars then.
Exactly.
So how are people coping day to day with buying food, for example, affording power?
Yeah, it's now really a cash economy. The central, the banking sector is not working at all as a banking sector, but as a cashier. So the people, they are surviving first with their very low income. But there is something particular to Lebanon is the help or the aid or the remittances that comes from diaspora, the Lebanese diaspora. The amount of remittances that comes to Lebanon is about 20 to 30%, and it is among the highest in the world. The Lebanese population is spread everywhere in the world, and we have four times more Lebanese outside Lebanon than Lebanese inside Lebanon, and this is the unique case in all the world. So that's why Lebanon is always surviving, even if we have very difficult periods during war, crisis, or attack, or others. It really relies a lot on foreign or money or the remittances coming from diaspora.
What do you fear the impact could be economically on ordinary Lebanese ability to afford food if this slide to war continues?
The ability to, the main constraint now is the borders or how to transport food, because Lebanon imports almost everything. We have always had a trade deficit. Lebanon doesn't really produce enough products to be self-sufficient, but it always imports from abroad. And since we don't have really borders with Syria and with other, we don't have borders except with plane. So if we have any attack on the airport, this will be really it will thread really the import to Lebanon. So this is how we cannot really afford our daily needs, especially for oil, petroleum products, not only food.
Thank you.
Is the main threat.
Thank you very much indeed for joining us. We really appreciate that. Lael Mansour there, who's a lecturer in economics at the Lebanese American University. And you can get the latest on this developing story in the Middle East. There is a live page running on the BBC website at bbcnews.com. We head to Asia now, where Japanese businesses in China are improving security for staff and their families following the killing of a 10-year-old Japanese boy in the Chinese city of Shenzhen. The electronics firm Panasonic said it would allow workers and their dependents to return home. The boy was stabbed on his way to school on Wednesday. A suspect is in custody. Now, the motive is not yet clear, but the killing has raised tension between Asia's two biggest economies. And this is not the first time that tension has increased. There is widespread dislike of Japan in China because of its wartime aggression, a sentiment that analysts say is fueled by the Chinese government. Well, I've been talking to Lim Tae-wei, who is a research fellow at the East Asian Institute at the National University of Singapore.
The bilateral relations tend to undergo cyclical patterns. And right now, it was before this incident, improving, especially with the visit by more China-friendly politicians from Japan. With this incident, it's kind of throws something of a black swan into the bilateral relationship. However, one has to note that today, the Chinese side has also announced that they will gradually lift the restrictions on seafood imports from Japan. And that appears to once again sort of soften the blow of this incident.
Why does the relationship between China and Japan go through better periods and then much worse periods on a seemingly regular basis?
This has been the case in the contemporary period because the relationship has been based on different interpretations or different sort of selective memories of history. And also it is complicated by territorial disputes. And also, you know, state education that places a premium on historical events. As a result, these factors combine together into a conflagration of complexities and complications for the bilateral relationship. At the same time, economically, you know, the two of them are very close. They have, cross investments in each other, and they have been a part of the supply chain, especially before the pandemic. And so in terms of industrial production, the two countries are somewhat interdependent with each other.
We did see over a decade or so ago, relations economically deteriorate significantly. There were instances in China of Japanese businesses being attacked, of Japanese cars being burnt, weren't there? Do you think there is a danger that relations economically could plummet again?
In the past, there was a separation of economics and politics known as Seike Bunri. However, currently it is complicated by an emerging geopolitical factor, which is the Sino-US contestation. And with the Sino-US contestation, it's not just Japan, but almost all countries in the region are facing this very difficult navigational path ahead. Because it makes the separation of politics and economics very difficult.
If there is a falling out between the two biggest economies in Asia, that surely would have a region-wide, potentially a global impact.
Yes, indeed. However, it is unlikely that there will be a very serious falling out from this incident because there are other factors in play that prevents the issue from spiraling out of control. So, for example, domestically, the Chinese are trying to contain the fallout from the incident. And in the case of Japan, they are handling it very calmly, in particular since there has been a long-drawn discussion about the seafood exports to China. So this incident will play into a myriad of factors. It may throw a spanner into the works. However, it is unlikely to overturn the bilateral relations because there is very strong incentives on both sides to maintain the relationship.
Lim Tai Wei there in Singapore. You're with World Business Report from the BBC World Service. Let's have a look at some of the other big stories around today with Shanti Kellerman, the Chief Investment Officer at M&G Wealth. Hi, Shanti. Welcome back to the programme.
Hi, Rob.
Can we talk about the UK economy? Because UK national debt has hit 100% of the country's annual economic output, the highest level since the 60s. And the new Labour government, only been in office a few months or so, of course, is preparing to deliver its first budget next month. Is this going to be a big issue for them?
Well, it's already been flagged as an issue. And Rachel Reeves has talked a lot about the money that's, some of the black hole stuff. I think the interesting thing in the data is they both had higher tax receipts. So they were higher expected and the spending was higher than expected. It's linked to public sector pay being raised. It's linked to more benefits payouts. And it's also just general inflation. It hits governments as well as ordinary people. So we'll have to see. Obviously, no one knows yet what they're going to do about it. But they're probably going to have to take some action to stop the hype of that increase. Government borrowing isn't bad, but it just needs to be used and invested in a productive way that will deliver long-term returns. You know, if you're just using it to buy daily consumption, it's probably not going to add value. If you're actually doing infrastructure or children's schooling skills, then that thing can have a return on investment.
You mentioned Rachel Reeves a minute or so ago. She's the new finance minister, the Chancellor of the Exchequer, as the official title is. And she and other ministers have been talking about just how terrible public services are and how awful the state of the nation's finances are. And we've had this report today suggesting that consumer confidence has fallen pretty sharply in the UK. Do you think government ministers have maybe overdone the misery?
Well, I mean, on the other hand, we also had out today that retail sales were up 1% in August. So that doesn't really paint a picture of that gloomy a population if we're all spending more money. So I think it's a balance. We know that there's issues with public services, and some of that investment in public services might actually pay returns in the long run if you could get more people into the workforce, if you can get people to be more productive. So it's not just about let's stop all spending. I think it's more about spending in the right way to get the returns that we want for the country.
And briefly, shares in Mercedes-Benz down more than 7% on Friday after the German carmaker lowered its full-year profit outlook, yet another company raising concerns about weak demand in China.
Yeah, so Mercedes, like a lot of the other car brands, has been trying to go more into the premium expensive cars because the margins are a bit better there. Demand is usually a bit less economically sensitive. But the problem is everyone's gone there, BMW, Porsche, and demand for some of those areas is falling. So a lot of other car companies have also pulled back expectations. I think it's probably more to come in that sector.
Thank you, as always, Shanti Kellerman there from M&G Wealth. Now we're going to talk about the sportswear brand Nike, well known, of course, for its swoosh logo and its slogan, Just Do It. For years, Nike has been one of the biggest sports brands in the world. But the firm has been facing tough competition from newer rivals, which some analysts say are just more innovative. They're on top of trends more than Nike is. Well, now the boss of Nike, John Donahoe, has said he's going to step down. But is a change at the top enough to propel Nike back to its former glory days? We're going to talk now to Derek Morrison, Global Managing Director of Unidays Marketplace, which is an online portal to help students get discounts on branded items. Welcome to the programme, Derek. Just tell
us, thanks for having me.
Where in your view Nike's been going wrong or not performing as well as it did?
Well, I think if you think about Nike as a lifestyle brand and as a performance brand, there's two really important, I think, compounding trends that we've seen. And for the longest time, Nike was the most, eminent pillar of youth culture. And that was kind of, you're seeing that the brand influence across all different aspects. But then within the performance side, there were also leaps and bounds beyond in terms of technology in footwear. And you could say that the competition has leveled the field to some degree on the performance side. And you've seen the kind of for lack of a better word, neglect of the community that had really legitimized them as a cultural pillar in the lifestyle sector. And so when you have a more competitive landscape on the product differentiation, and then you have a shift in trend in kind of consumer sentiment and cultural sentiment, I think that's what you're seeing combined to compound into the trajectory that we've seen. And,
When you talk about innovation in footwear, mm-hmm. are we just talking about new designs, or does it go beyond that?
Well, I think it's a bit of both. So if you look on the lifestyle side, Virgil Abloh, or the kind of cultural influence in the design side and the creative side, it was, a really powerful voice and brand in that space of things. But then when you look at them in terms of technology and innovation and performance wear, they're for the longest time, it was nobody could keep up with Air technology or the other things that they were investing in the technology of the footwear as well. And I think you've seen people catch up in both sides, but the Nike for a long time believed in the investment in building that kind of cultural legitimacy and how that would spill over into the kind of mainstream consumption or, everyday running shoe, not just what people are wearing at high level elite performance. And it's so you see a little bit of both sides of it. And you have to think of both lanes in terms of understanding Nike's evolution.
And does changing the person at the very top of an organization actually make much of a difference when it comes to the design or the innovation, or frankly, whether young people regard a particular brand as cool or passé?
I think it is an important role. And, you could argue, is it too late to regain the dominance of the youth conversation? Or what will it take from now to recover that position? I think there's still a lot of love, and Nike's still a dominant force, but to the extent that they were before, the extent that they were before isn't the same dominance. 64% of youth still consider Nike as a brand, but where that was relative to 3 years ago is probably much, much lower than it was. So they'll have to readjust their approach to some degree to be able to get to back to where they were. But it's not entirely a lost cause. But I think ultimately, you need to have that belief in that strategy and the conviction of how you're going to, nurture that community that I think does start from the top. And it is an important place, position within that.
Okay. So it's not a brand that's going to disappear, you don't think, in a few years. It's still got life in it yet.
Definitely. I mean, but it's different. 3 years ago, I'm currently at Student Fashion Week right now. And, 3 years ago at any sort of Fashion Week activation, you'd see the vast majority of people on their feet would be wearing some sort of Nike or Jordan product. And if you look around the room today, it's probably 1 in 10 is what I'm seeing on side of this activation. And people aren't just wearing sneakers, but they're also wearing Doc Martens and loafers and all other kinds of things. So there's some other kind of behavioral shifts we've seen in the lifestyle side. But
thank you. Fascinating insight into that event you're at there. Thank you very much indeed. Derek Morrison there from Unid Days. Now, something you need to wear sneakers or trainers for, of course, is basketball. We're going to talk now about women's basketball in the United States. It is a sport that has seen impressive growth in recent years, and particularly this season, with a boost in sponsorship and broadcast deals, increased media attention and higher viewership. But is this momentum translating into profitability? Is the WNBA getting closer to making money, and can its growing fan base turn into sustainable business success? Izzy Greenfield has been taking a look.
I play basketball, and my coach, he got tickets, and then Daddy bought them, and we went to a game, and then after that, I got really into it, and now this is my 7th game I've gone to.
That's 6-year-old Colvin Brittany, who can barely contain his excitement as he waits in the queue to watch his favourite WNBA team, the New York Liberty. And he's not the only one who's excited. C.H. Reynolds is also a huge basketball fan and says the league is like a family.
I feel like the NBA is built on stars in such a crazy way. And with the WNBA, it's built on teams. I mean, this is an unfortunate way to think about it, and I wish I didn't think this way, but we live in a capitalist society. It'll take off as long as there are stars who can help it take off. As long as the economics follow the popularity, I think the teams and the sport can grow.
The WNBA has experienced somewhat of a breakout year in the 2024 season, which runs from May to October. There's been success both on and off the court. Launched in 1996 as the women's counterpart to the NBA, the Professional Basketball League for Women is based in the United States. And this year, players like Breanna Stewart and rising superstar Caitlin Clark have captivated fans, and the league has seen record attendance and viewership numbers. On the sidelines, the WNBA has secured some landmark broadcast deals. New York City-based sports writer Erica Ayala says these deals are really important for the WNBA's status.
Prime has stepped up once again. They have an 11-year media rights deal, which includes Disney, so that's ABC, ESPN, and the whole Disney family, Amazon Prime, and NBC has come back into the fold. What we understand is that the WNBA is going to receive about $200 million a year in this 11-year deal. And the deal will begin in 2026. We're starting to see now that there's a little bit of more competition. You know, Prime really came in big time. And I think people are a little surprised that some of the bigger events are going to be on Amazon Prime, and the price of expansion has gone up for the WNBA, but people are coming up with that money. They are paying these new prices. And so, you know, there's a saying, a cultural saying here in the United States, yesterday's price is not today's price. And that is definitely what we're seeing in the WNBA.
The Men's Basketball League, the NBA, is one of the most profitable professional sports in the United States. It pulls in estimated $10 billion annually. And despite its popularity, the women's game still struggles with a smaller fan base compared to the men's, which limits things like ticket sales and merchandise revenue. In 2018, current NBA Commissioner Adam Silver said that the WNBA had lost an average of $10 million annually since it was founded. The Washington Post has reported that the league and its teams are expected to lose around $50 million in 2024. Back to Erica Ayala.
You know, that's a little bit of a tricky conversation. One, because of just what is and is not reported directly from the NBA and even from the WNBA and its teams. I guess the question that I have is, if you have the WNBA, a part of a larger umbrella organization, and that organization is touting that the WNBA loses them money, at what point is the larger umbrella organization going to take control?
That's it from this edition of World Business Report. Bye-bye.
I'm Gabriel Gatehouse, and from BBC Radio 4, this is Series 2 of The Coming Storm. There's a divide in American politics between those who think democracy is in peril and those who think it's already been subverted, hollowed out from the inside. As America prepares to elect its next president, we go through the looking glass into a world where nothing is as it seems, and the institutions of the state are a facade. Listen wherever you get your BBC podcasts.